With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the Complex Sneakers Podcast. I am Joe LaPuma. I'm here with my guys to my right, Matt Welty.
Hey, how's it going?
And Brendan Dunn.
Welty, your pores look incredible. The mud mask you posted on Instagram is working.
Thanks.
Okay. That's,
don't you think?
Yeah, that's good that you're giving it. You're giving him props.
I support it.
Yeah. Self-care Sundays.
I support it,
self-care,
man.
Self-care Sundays. Also, what it's was that? You put steak in a pepper? Was that what it was?
It's chili relleno.
God, this guy's different. Different preparation for this week.
Oh my God! Well,
cheese, mushrooms, garlic,
it looked good.
Steak.
It looked really good. But
and you said I have your permission to meme that, the photo of you with the mask on.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I'm glad that you prepared yesterday because we have a big week and we have a big episode today. Russ Bankston has been writing about basketball and sneakers for over three decades, served as the EIC of Slam Magazine, helped produce the first issues of Kicks Magazine, and then later in his career spent 7 years at Complex being a guiding voice of the sneakers vertical. He is widely considered the best writer on the subjects of sneakers and has a new book titled The History of Basketball and 15 Sneakers on the way. Welcome, Russ, to
on
the podcast.
On the way is a good way to put it.
Is it?
But yeah.
We're not too early mentioning it, though, right?
No, not at all. Awesome. Not at all. In fact, the more it gets mentioned, it's probably better.
Okay.
The pressure's on.
The pressure is on.
When's the release date for the...
We don't have a release date yet. We have, a due date, and that's going to be entertaining in and of itself. I'm going to, start sweating just talking about it, but, middle of May.
Well, there's no one better to write a sneaker book than you. And
appreciate it.
Happy to have you back in the office. We've worked together, for, seven
forever.
Years, and it's always great reconnecting with you. And I think for, what we're going to spend the time on for the first half of the podcast, there's no one really better to talk to. And you were in Australia for 2 weeks, and the unfortunate news of Kobe Bryant and the other people who lost their lives in the crash that happened around 2 weeks ago. We didn't want to touch on it until we had the right person to really talk about it. I know that you in 1996 was the first time you met Kobe Bryant and then interviewed him a bunch of times throughout the years, and just kind of your career's progressing. What stuck out to you through your interactions with him?
Man, it was a lot. And to rewind a second, finding out about it super early in the morning, first thing when I woke up, and just kind of staring at my phone for a while, being wait, no, I got to read this a bunch of times. And just obviously any death like that is going to catch you by surprise. But this was something that Kobe's second act following his playing career has been so vibrant and so full, it makes it almost more unbelievable, where it's if it's someone who's already out of the public eye, you're just oh my God. But the first time I met him was in 1996 in Pittsburgh at the McDonald's All-America game.
Right.
And everyone kind of already knew who he was. He was already starting to get attention. Obviously he's the son of a former player. He already had some of those Jordan-esque mannerisms, even as a high schooler. And, the thing I remember most about meeting him there was that he was 17, I was 25. And I told him there, I told people afterwards, he seemed more adult than I did.
Okay.
It's he was more together and more
locked in.
Yeah. I mean, just he was already a professional.
He
hadn't declared yet, but the way he dealt with the media, the way he dealt with his teammates, the way he dealt with, other people who interacted with him, he was just a pro. I never saw him when he wasn't like that. I don't know how young he was before he sort of
became a man.
Came into that. Yeah. It's we can go back to his announcement with the sunglasses on his head Mm-hmm. And like people made fun of him for that. But outside of that, like making that announcement, like as the first guard to go pro out of high school, you know, like he was so ready for it.
How did you become friends with Kobe? Because Russ, you've been covering sneakers, like Joe said, covering basketball for so long that I could tell there was some sort of familiarity between if you step into a room with Kobe, which you have done a bunch of times, to announce a new shoe or to cover a new release, and Kobe knows who Russ Bankston is. How did that happen?
I mean,
everyone knows who Russ Bankston is, but
okay, I don't know about that. Fair. But that's what made this all so much worse, because Kobe was a guy I felt like, you know, we kind of came into the game at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, 96 McDonald's game, I had just started doing basketball with Slam around then. So our careers kind of paralleled each other to a degree. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to be able to go to All-Star every year, go to the finals every year, mm-hmm. when he was going to All-Star every year and being in the finals every year. And somehow we would always manage to carve out time, whether it was official or not. Like, there were two Kicks covers after the initial Garnett one that were Kobe back to back.
Wow.
And
Kicks, for people who don't know, is the sneaker dedicated offshoot of Slam.
Slam Magazine.
Right. There was an annual, right. And still is an annual. And I believe Kobe was the cover in 2000 and 2001. Mm-hmm. And we had long conversations for both of those covers in Teaneck, New Jersey, where ABCD camp was. Mm-hmm. And I just remember, like, even in one of those conversations, the first year it was like basically just me and him in a hotel room talking. Mm-hmm. And the second year he had security. He had like an armed security guard, wow. who I think he had with him for the rest of his career after that. And I remember him telling me even during that thing, like, you know, this isn't me. Like, you know me, like this isn't, but this is the reality of it now. And we would just catch up, mm-hmm. you know, all the time. Like, and it's funny because I would literally catch up with him more than I catch up with actual friends from home or whatever, mm-hmm. you know.
Interesting.
And there's just, I don't know, there's so many times that stand out. You know, it's like I remember going to DC for All-Star in 2001, and the whole media would kind of travel around as a pack to each player. Mm-hmm. So Kobe was kind of alone in his locker, and I went over to him and we just started talking about whatever. They were going to play the Nets the first game after the break. So it was like talking about Marbury, talking about whatever. And like no one's in the locker next to him. So I just sat down. So we're just sitting there talking. And as we're talking, the room kind of gets quiet. And I look up and that entire media mass had come over to get Kobe. And we're just talking. And I'm like, I'll catch up with you later. No, yeah. let me you do this. You know, so things like that would happen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this was also during the time when he eventually went to Nike and they would do events every year. Mm-hmm. So I would see him in LA. I saw him at Lower Merion when they dedicated the gym when he switched to number 24. I saw him in New York for a couple of things. The one I posted on Instagram was actually like a Body Armor MMA thing that he was coming to just because he was a Body Armor guy.
Right.
After Colorado happened in 2003 and the rape allegations and the story came out, and it still looks terrible. You mm-hmm. know, I think a lot of the better stories that came out after this, like, did not shy away from it. And like, you know, unfortunately, it's something that everyone's going to have to grapple with his mm-hmm. career forever. Mm-hmm. I just remember feeling like wild uncomfortable about it. And just like, I don't know how to feel about this guy right now. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like we'd interacted for years, but did I have any idea who he is?
Right.
You know, maybe not. Mm-hmm. And obviously the Lakers would only come in New York twice a year for Jersey and New York. That year, I think, I didn't see him at all. So I didn't see him for over a year. Mm-hmm. And I went to Indiana. And whenever I would go to games, I would get there as early as they would let people into the gym. Mm-hmm. And I walk into the field house. And there's no one else there. And Kobe's on the court shooting. And as I came out of the tunnel on the opposite side of the court, he spots me, like yells out my name to say hi and comes over. And, you know, it was just like, but I'm just like one of
right.
a zillion people this guy interacts with mm-hmm. every day. And it's like, I haven't seen you in over a year and you still remember who I am and like still are. And like, that doesn't take away from anything that happened, mm-hmm. but at the same time, it's like,
You felt like you knew him.
Yeah.
There was a connection. Yeah, you guys had like rapport and a connection there for sure.
There's also the legendary photo of you with the snake around your neck from the Kobe photo shoot.
Slam. Yeah. It was like the Mamba issue, right?
Yeah, it was like after the Black Mamba name came out, and the idea, I forget who at Slam came up with the idea, but like to get Kobe with a snake around his neck. And we obviously had like a reptile wrangler show up. I was writing the story.
Like Steve Irwin shows up. Like,
basically, with snakes in like a cooler, you know, you're keeping them like chill so they're not like hyperactive. And the photo of me, I think, is like they're boa constrictors. I think they're boa constrictors. And the snake we ended up using was like a king snake because you wanted to use something black to be a Black Mamba. And I think the funny thing is the Black Mamba isn't even black. Like, I'm pretty sure the Black Mamba's name is because, like, inside its mouth is black.
Kind of like Rhode Island.
Don't quote me on that because I'm not Steve Irwin. What? Oh, not being an island?
Or road, but go on.
I mean, I got to do the snake test Polaroid.
And then you said that you saw him in December?
I didn't. So, you know, obviously as part of the book, like, you know, the idea is kind of going through the history of basketball, starting with the Chuck Taylor, ending with the Adapt BB, and just kind of tracing the evolution of both.
Okay.
And, you know, from the beginning, I knew I wanted to use one of Kobe's shoes as that touch point, and ideally the 4. Because I feel like the 4 was the one. I was kind of torn, like 4 or 5. But I think the 4 was the one that really got the ball rolling on that low top vibe and the relationship with him and Avar and everything else. So
an interesting shoe too, because I think around the time of the Kobe 3, like Eric Avar was diagnosed with cancer, which he eventually bounced back from. So I think the 3 Avar was like less involved.
And the 3 was like models. A wildly different, you know, the polarizing
shoe. The first couple of shoes I remember like just being strange. Everyone was really hyped on the Zoom Kobe 1. I remember on Nike Talk, everyone's like, this is my favorite basketball shoe. The 2 had a lot of problems because they made like 3 versions of it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They had a strap that like kept on becoming unbuttoned. The 3 was that ugly like zigzag.
The weird like basket, like,
But also when they launched the 4, that's when they came out with the MVP puppet characters where like I remember there was that big Foot Locker commercial where the shoes like lit on fire in the back. I remember working there at the time and everyone came in because they saw that commercial that like there was a real hype around Kobe Bryant sneakers at that time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, obviously he wore it to win his 4th title.
Yeah.
So it's like that kind of helped create the myth of it too. But it's funny, like I was going to go back to a lot of my archival stuff because I've talked to Kobe a bunch and like obviously he's spoken at all these sneaker launches, but I figured like, you know, try and get him. My friend Svi, who used to be at Slam and at Stance, is now at the Mamba Academy.
Okay.
And I'd forgotten another friend, Molly Carter, who used to be PR at Converse, is like basically the head of Kobe's like business side of things. So I hit up Molly to see if I could get Kobe, and things came together pretty quickly. And they're like, well, you know, we have time on the 23rd, on December 23rd.
Wow. 2019.
2 days before Christmas too, you know. Like, well, you know, we can give you 10 to 15 minutes. And I ended up getting 20.
Okay.
And that's kind of the thing where it's like, especially if it's someone I know, I don't care what the time constraint is, because once I get them on the phone, then it's like they're going to talk as long as they want to. No one's going to tell Kobe, like, time's up.
Yeah.
And man, like, it's just so hard to listen back to it now.
I bet.
And it's one of those things where it's like, neither way is good. You know, it's like, had I not spoken to him, and he passed away, I would have had so many regrets on not having spoken to him. But having spoken to him so recently, like, made it even harder to deal with. You know, it's like literally the first thing I said to him on the phone was congratulations on the Hall of Fame nomination. And like, obviously the induction's going to happen. You know, it's like, so I got to tell him that. And at the end I did, you know, say like, I really got to try and get there.
You'll be there, yeah.
Because like for him and KG, who's another guy I've had a long history with, you know, this was going to be one of those inductions, you know, and now everyone probably for a while, forever, is going to be guys I grew up either covering or watching, you know, Iverson being obviously one of the first. But what made it even worse, and I mean, the Gianna news made it worse on its own.
Absolutely.
But one of the things we talked about during that conversation was that clip of him talking to Gianna at the Nets game.
Right.
You know, because one of the things I wanted to talk to him about was like how he watches the game now and how that's changed from when he was active. So I wanted to know what he was talking to her about. So to hear him talk about that and to hear him talk about her, and a month later for them both to be gone, you know, it's like...
Unbelievable.
The way Gianna was playing and the way they were interacting, you know, it's like, it would have been hard if it was just Kobe. But at least you would have been able to say, like, well, she's going to be the one to carry on the torch. Mm-hmm. And to lose both, like, it's real. I mean, it's literally unthinkable.
Yeah.
What do you think Kobe's kind of, I know you mentioned the four briefly, but what do you think Kobe's lasting, like, sneaker legacy is?
That's hard. You know, it's like, I mean, I think bringing, you know, overall, it's probably bringing the low top back into basketball in a major way. Mm. And just
with the Kobe 4.
Yeah. And not that he was the first guy to wear a low top, but I feel like that was one of the first low tops engineered from the ground up instead of just being a high top that got cut down, mm-hmm. you know, and just sort of pushing things forward. And I think like the relationship between him and Avar is a big thing too, where it's like, you know, while obviously Jordan and Tinker is like the pinnacle of that. But I think a lot of that was more style based. And with Kobe, it was more, how do I get this so I can play better?
Yeah, I it's so interesting because, you know, we all cover this stuff, but people have always said that Kobe and Nike designer Eric Avar, who you mentioned, were closer than any other athlete designer combination. You know, every press release from a brand talks about how closely this new athlete worked with their designer, but with Kobe, you really believed it, and people on the inside really told you.
There was,
you
know, like stories that they went like scuba diving together and stuff, like on vacation. Yeah. Like
Russ, really early on, did you have a sense that Kobe cared about sneakers, like 97, 96, when you were first meeting him?
It's hard to say with some of the Adidas stuff. You know, I think, especially back then in the late 90s, there was that weird disconnect with Adidas where like so much of the direction was coming out of Germany. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the things that ended up getting produced, like the much maligned Kobe 2, mm-hmm. you know, looking back at that, it's like, well, sneakers are designed for cars. Let's have a car designer do a sneaker.
Mm-hmm. They actually brought in a guy from Audi.
Right. And he did the Kobe, which the Sunshine one to me is still one of the best Kobes ever. I love that shoe. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was another shoe we won a title in. But also, it's interesting to me with Kobe himself, and I think, you know, when he adopted that Black Mamba persona, you know, obviously some of that came out of what happened in Colorado mm-hmm. and him feeling like he needed to like have that split between his off-court persona and on-court persona. Mm-hmm. But I think in the 90s, he was still so wanting to be accepted and not a matter of like, this is who I am, you're going to accept me, being like, what do I do to be accepted? Yeah. And I think when the Kobe 2 got ridiculed, which it did fairly early on, looking like a toaster and whatever else. Kobe 2, yeah. He abandoned that shoe.
Yeah.
You know, and that was kind of the beginning of the end of the relationship with him and Adidas. And I kind of wonder, and I didn't ask him about this, and I wish I did, but, you know, I wonder, had he worn it anyway? Had he just said, the hell with what anyone else thinks, and worn it through that finals run, whether the reception of that shoe would have changed. Mm. And I think it might have. Yeah. I think it might have.
Do you have any rare... I know you have a lot of very rare sneakers in the stash, you know, stuff you were getting from samples.
Deion Sanders, Jordan 11 cleats.
Yeah, do you have a few things. Yeah.
Do you have any really rare Kobe stuff that people haven't seen?
Not that people haven't seen, I don't think. I've had things over the years. I mean, I had a sample pair of Kobe 1s that I think I got rid of because I really didn't love that shoe, the Nike Kobe 1. Mm-hmm. And I seem to recall one of the first times I wore it, I tightened it up and the upper like little plastic lace thing snapped. And it's like, well, okay, that's why it's a sample.
Quality control was the worst for me.
I do. I mean, one of the pairs I'll never get rid of is a pair of the charcoal or maybe black. I forget if they did both. The Adidas Kobe 1 in his size signed to me.
Wow.
So like, I mean, that I'm going to hang on to, obviously. Mm-hmm. One pair I had that I ended up giving to Ryan Jones at Slam was a pair of those American flag Kobe 2s.
Yeah. Crazy shoe.
The ones that LeBron wore. And yes. The craziest part about that was they obviously didn't come in a box because they were a sample, but they came in it was basically like an LV dust bag,
okay.
Like a brown, you know, sort of satiny dust bag. But instead of any sort of monogram, it was the Kobe Afro logo
for Obi
repeating print. Mm-hmm. That I wish I kept. The shoes I could live without. Those were Those are one of those shoes that were cool because there were so few of them.
Speaking of other funny, not funny, but like malign kind of Kobe sneakers, you were also at the 9 launch, I believe, the super high. Super high. I think you did, like, you got to interview Kobe about that, did like a video like during like the Quick Strike era.
Yeah.
But what was your thoughts when you first saw that shoe?
Oh, I mean, it was super strange. It was super strange. And it was such like a, it was such a swerve, you mm-hmm. know, and it's like, you know, talking about the relationship between Kobe and Avar and like what they did with the low tops from the 4 all the way through, like, well, even through that, because they ended up doing a low top version of the 10 and low, whatever else. Yeah. And I think it was just refined. So for them to do something so entirely different was just kind of like, what are you guys doing?
For the listeners who don't know, that's when Kobe was coming off the huge injury. Achilles tear.
Right. Like the, and they did like the red stripes,
the sutures up the back.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, yeah. But I think like, I just feel like Kobe was always curious, you know, and he was always looking for whatever edge he could find and do things differently. And I think once you got through a few iterations of the low and a few years removed from the 4 and other athletes and other brands were starting to get into like low top basketball, it's like, how do we go in an entirely different direction? Mm-hmm. You know, and that shoe, I mean, that shoe's still crazy. I mean, I have a pair of those tucked away somewhere.
Yeah, but. And it's funny, though, on sneaker shopping, a lot of the young kids, it stands out to them. Even, like, very young kind of artists, I guess because it was such, like, a pivot, and it's one of those shoes where you look at them and you immediately recognize it.
And it's just from that era. I think we've talked about it on here, but when Nike basketball was so hot and every new KD shoe or every new LeBron shoe or Kobe shoe was so big, just a few years removed from the Galaxy stuff in 2012, like, for young people who are, like, 20 to 25 right now, like, I feel like Nike basketball probably means so much to them if they grew up into sneakers because they were so hot for so long.
Yeah. A funny thing about that shoe, and I think is maybe a good transition into talking about other stuff, is I remember you wrote a story about it, Russ, when we had a debate in the office where we had already spoke about it on the podcast, where Joe was like, can you make this shoe hot? How do you wear a shoe that's like up to your shin? And you know, coming from wearing sneakers in the 80s, like the whole like David Robinson super high top era, you're like, you fucking put your jeans on, you roll it up, and you wear the damn shoe.
And that's what's great about him. He could wear any sneaker. Like, that's what was always so refreshing, is that you would just wear any sneaker. You know, this guy has the Adidas thing. Yeah. You could say that I'm like into the hyped. You're more kind of like Reebok kind of, but
Brandon Classic.
You used to wear any sneaker and like be excited about the most obscure sneaker versus like a Jordan 3 and Jordan 4, which I always really like admired about you.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. That, and it's like, I haven't worn that Kobe 9 in a long time, you know? Mm-hmm. I definitely plan on digging out some of my Kobe stuff to give it another ride, you know? And there's a few things in there that I don't think I've ever worn, you know? Like some of the elites maybe are in there somewhere. But it was an interesting time.
I remember, like, to kind of exemplify it, I think when we first started working together, you went heavy on wearing all white Velcro Janowski SBs.
I love it.
Every day, like, didn't give a fuck. Just like, I'm going to wear Velcro sneakers every single day.
I love those shoes. And like, it's kind of funny. Like, you know, I wrote something a while ago for GQ about trying to wear just Adidas campuses a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been doing that. And it kind of became like,
campuses on right now.
I do. Yes. It became a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's like, man, I wrote this, so I better do it. But at the same time, it was like, I don't want to spend so much time figuring out like, all right,
yeah,
what am I going to wear? And like, what can I wear every day mm-hmm. that I just don't have to worry about it?
The one shoe that you became an influencer on in a kind of ironic sort of way was the Nike Monarch. You were very early on.
Is that
like,
right?
He wrote a story. It was like 10 ways to wear the Nike Monarch. Like before that. It became ironically cool.
But that's the thing. Like, I feel like I pumped up the Monarch at one point and then it became hot. And then it was just like,
what look at this monster.
Yeah. I've what created. Are you people doing?
Yeah. Yeah.
It was like a Roche Run thing almost where it's like, oh, really? But, yeah.
Russ, I want to talk about your own history going back. You know, you've been doing this for decades. Like we said, we're not going to out your exact age, although I have some...
You certainly can.
You have some intel on it?
Some guesses. No. you know, for people around my age, around Welty's age, when we first got into this industry, we looked up to Russ Bengtsson. That was the person.
Appreciate it.
You know, and people younger these days, if they want to get into writing about sneakers or covering sneakers professionally, it's a job title and there's a whole scene about it, but Russ, you were one of the first people to really do this, and we can't overstate your importance in that. I mean, Bob Beato was maybe a few years before you, but
yeah.
You know, as far as like a professional full-time journalist who cared about sneakers and who was writing about sneakers, that was you. But that didn't exist when you were a kid. So how did you take that thing you loved and somehow turn it into a job? Or, you know, how much did you care at first to be able to translate it into working in sneakers?
You know, I mean, it's funny, like, so the first thing I wrote about sneakers that ever got published was a column about, like, random 80 sneakers that I wrote for my college newspaper. Mm-hmm. So this would have been in, like, around similar time as Bob Beato, like, 90, 91, 92, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think, I mean, I'm sure I've told this story before, but out grocery shopping or wandering a grocery store in Delaware when I was in college, mm-hmm. or right after college, at like 2 a.m. and found a copy of the first issue of Slam on the stands. Mm-hmm. And as I flipped through it, you know, it's like, how do I write for this? Like, these yeah. guys are speaking my language. Like, it's basketball. They covered sneakers from the very beginning before okay. I even got involved. Part of me was like, I want to write for them so I have an in to actually be able to get certain shoes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Like, there was actually a thought about that before I even realized that was remotely possible.
Right.
Because this was around the time when the first round of Jordan Retros were coming out.
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, had I waited, I could have gotten them all for like $20 a pair, but...
And resold them for thousands of years later.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Instead, I spent like $80, and then, which was like all the money I had back then, and watched like the price drop and be like...
Bad investments.
And I didn't even buy more. Yeah. I should have. Yeah. But, you know, I just bothered those people until they let me write for them. Mm-hmm. I mean, Tony Gervino, who's still a close friend, like at Tidal now, like... He was the editor-in-chief, and I would just fax them all the time. Faxes, kids.
Yeah.
Ask your parents.
Never heard of it. Growing up in Long Island, though...
Another Long Island guy.
You were paying attention to sneakers, and I assume it wasn't a thing that everybody knew about, or it was kind of rare back then to really care about sneakers, right? Like, what were those moments?
I mean, it's kind of funny, and like, I tell Bob Beato this every time I talk to him, but, you know, where'd you get those... starts way early, and he sort of declares like 1986, like when the Jordan 1 came out, like, or 85-86 is like the demarcation line, like that's when it ended for him.
This is Bob Beato's book, a seminal piece of sneaker writing.
Where'd you get those? Yeah. And for a while I was like, wait a minute, like that was the beginning for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like growing up in the suburbs, sneakers were so different, you know, for Bob Beato being in the city and being a little bit older than I am. Sorry, mm-hmm. Bob, I won't tell your exact age either. You know, they were like searching for stuff at Jerry Cosby and Jew Man and, you know, all these other stores. And for me, like, the beginning was more like seeing stuff at Athlete's Foot.
Okay.
Or seeing stuff at the mall. What was
that stuff?
This would have been like, I mean, well, the Jordan 1 mm-hmm. was a big thing for me. I remember seeing the Jordan 1 when it first came out and, like, really wanting those. And a story that I'm sure many people my age can share. Parents were like, $65 for a pair of shoes that you're going to grow out of and like and destroy in a year? No.
Mm-hmm.
So instead, I ended up, ironically enough, getting a pair of Nike Air Ships at a Marshalls for like $35.
Wow.
So like...
And now look, they're doing... Yeah.
The Airship
this
retro,
was in like
right.
1985. And this was probably before I realized like that Jordan wore that shoe.
Yeah.
You know, like I just knew it was a Nike Air basketball shoe
mm-hmm.
that was in the price range that
and
was acceptable.
And kind of like a Jordan 1.
Yeah. But you know, there were other kids who were into it. You know, I think like into it in the sense of like they're going to wear new pairs of shoes all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't name names even though the statute of limitations I'm sure is up. But there was a kid in my homeroom who worked at Athlete's Foot and was running stuff out the back. You know, whenever they took the garbage out, he would take boxes of
shoes
and stash them under the dumpster.
That's what they used to do. Finish
them.
Line, too.
Yeah.
Like, where are all these shoes going? And that was the move. I'll take the garbage out.
The literal
like,
back door.
Yeah, why are you
were stealing sneakers?
Not about me, but I've never stolen a pair. But there was a lot of kids who were very excited to take the garbage out. And I'm like, what is going on? And that was the move. People would come to, like, there was, like, two dumpsters near the mall outside. It seemed like it was an easy way to steal things.
Oh, I'm sure. And back then, I mean, come on.
You were also big Jordan 2 guy. There's not a lot of people that they kind of note the Jordan 2 as like their favorite.
Our CEO Rich A loves the Jordan 2.
It's one of those things. It's like half personal and half like aesthetic. You know, it's like the Jordan 2 was the first Jordan I ever got that I bought with my own money, and like I bought it when the 3s came out. It went on sale, and like I don't know. I feel like that's a weird myth that builds up where it's like, Jordans never used to go on sale. And it's like, well, they actually always did.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there was a brief period when they didn't. But, you know, I got a pair of twos for like $70.
You didn't have to steal those out of Athlete's Foot.
I did not. I never worked at Athlete's Foot. I probably should have.
But were you? I want to go back to that storyline real quick. Like the guy who was floating pairs out the back door. Were you on that?
No. I was way too like innocent. No, but
you didn't buy them from him or anything?
No. Okay. I don't think he was even. I don't even know if he was selling stuff. And again, like I don't mean to impugn a former classmate, but you know, there was definitely like this kid's wearing like a new pair of shoes every single day.
Yeah.
And it's all the stuff from like the top of the wall. You know, it was like, this is like Air Force Two era.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, that whatever. I grew up in a suburbs where it's like you had like the upper middle class, and it's like, I still remember names of kids who wore like the hot stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like from high school, from 30 years ago. And it's like, I've since made up for that shoe-wise, but it's like, I still remember like who those kids
were.
Yeah,
I think you eclipsed them. How many pairs do you have in a storage unit in Long Island?
You know, again, I always say between 500 and 1,000. I'm sure it's closer to 1,000, but I mean, I've probably gotten rid of more pairs over the years than I have.
Yeah.
But
you also kind of realize too, and I mean, all of us working in media, where sometimes you just kind of really have to give things away before they even accumulate. Cause you can say, oh, I have a million pairs of shoes. But then when you're going through it, you're like, oh fuck, it's like Reebok ventilators and like Under Armour running shoes. And it adds up and you're like, I need to get rid of all this stuff.
And I mean, for me, and you guys will get there someday, but you know, it's like my reasoning for putting stuff away a lot was like, I'll want to wear this someday. And it's like there was a moment, I won't give exact age, maybe I will later, but you know, like once I hit my 40s and like maybe over 45, it's like, so that day I'm saving it for, like that's it's never now.
Wait.
No, it's either now or it's not coming at all. Because it's like when I was in my 20s, I could justify saying like 20 years from now,
these,
maybe
I'm
going to
break
these.
Next with these.
Yeah. And now it's like 20 years from now, I'm going to be back in the Velcro Janoskis. Like,
I think I remember you saying, you know, when you were still at Complex, you had broken out a pair of, I want to say it was the Prada America's Cup to wear to the office. You had them on dead stock or on ice or whatever from the early 2000s. And you said you would hit up Clark that morning because the sole fell off the shoes, like on the train.
Yeah, no, like it was a pair. It was a black pair of America Cups. I wore them a couple times back in the early 2000s and just had them stashed. Not that many.
That shoe was like you made it shoe,
the
though.
The uppers were perfect.
I never owned a pair, but I remember like if you had that shoe, it's like you are doing very well.
No, I mean, because I bought those when I was at Slam, when I was editor of Slam in the early 2000s. And shout out to Dennis Page, the publisher of Slam. I remember him wearing a pair of Prada Sports, like with the red stripe up the back and the little like metal, like, you know, I don't even know what you call that, but fastener on top. Mm-hmm. And I was like, and I remember going to like, I don't know if anyone remembers this spot, but Otto Tootsie Plowhound was a shoe store on Broadway near the Slam offices. And I bought like my first pair of Pradas there and ended up buying a couple pairs. I forget how many pairs of America Cups I had, but it was too many. But yeah, so this pair I broke out like 20 years later. They got Vibram bottoms. You think like these should survive forever.
Yeah.
And I was coming like up an escalator and I'm like, these feel strange. And like literally the entire midsole just turned to dust,
man,
of one shoe. Postscript is, I brought them to the Prada store on Broadway, and it was going to cost like $200 or something to get them resold. And at first, I was like, yeah, go ahead. And I was like, what are you doing? So I went back, and I was like, you know what? Just get rid of them. Like, forget it.
You talk about tucking sneakers away for years, for decades, but you're also not afraid to just like actually wear stuff. And I know that's like a big thing for you, wear your shoes. I think one of the shoes we all associate so closely with Russ.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Is the black supreme absolutely dunk low that you dog, that you
beat to hell.
Yeah, put many thousands of miles on. Tell me about first getting those Supreme Dunks from the Supreme store, how hard it was, how different Supreme was back then. Nike SB Dunk Low, black with the cement print, 2001.
Yeah, so
there's definitely pictures online of his pair that are beat to,
They're so bad. And like they're still in storage somewhere. Like I'm not sure exactly where. Like I can't wear them anymore.
Nesting in them.
I don't even
you had them in the office for a while though, right?
Yeah. Different laces in them now, yeah. Big rips off the back. I think you called
like your rain shoes at one point or something like that.
I remember like I played wiffle ball in those in like a muddy backyard. Like I wore those to Max Fish like every night for a long time. That's like amazing. If those sneakers could talk, they wouldn't want to talk. But you know, back then, the way Supreme released a shoe was they would trickle them out. Mm-hmm. They would sell like, I don't know how many, but like say a dozen or two dozen pairs a day. And you would have to go to the counter and ask if they had it and ask if they had your size. And if they said no, you come back the next day. And I had gotten to know some of those guys through like not only going to Supreme, but going to Max Fish. Like, so I would see guys there. So like I had a little bit of a relationship and I don't know, it probably took me a week to end up with a pair. And this would have been like early Nike Talk days too, which is probably the only way I knew like they were happening.
Right.
And I still remember, you know, I left Slam one day around lunchtime to take the train downtown, got a pair, brought them back to the office and put them on that day. Cause like,
and that was after getting denied how many times?
Five or six. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not a ton.
This
not
like some
ton.
Real like soup Nazi shit.
But it was...
Did you feel dissed when they told No.
Because, I mean, I kind of knew the guys already.
Yeah.
So, like, I figure, like, you know, I wasn't so in with them that they would, like, just lace me no matter what.
Right.
But I wasn't so out that, like, I didn't think they were telling me they were out of my size when they weren't to save them for someone else.
Okay.
Got it.
I still don't understand why I didn't go back again to try and get the white pair, other than I just wasn't buying stuff like that back then. But it was one of those things, you know, like, my whole reason for getting that shoe, and it's hard to... You know, when you look at things now and cement print's been used on so many different things, you know, back then it wasn't used on anything.
Yeah.
You know, it was the Jordan 3 and it was that. And I mean, obviously like weird iterations of the Trainer 1 and some other things. Mm-hmm. But like, as someone who was already into dunks and had bought like a bunch of the college ones and they came back in like 98 and 99.
Mm, be true to your school stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I wanted those Supremes and like, I was looking at those before I even got them as like, this is what I'm going to wear every day.
Mm.
And I mean, I wore those every day. You know, those immediately went into the rotation and did not come off. Those were the ones that sat by the door that I would just throw on every time I went out. And, you know, I did save the box. I have the receipt. Like, that's all back in storage. Like, I'm kind of curious. I need to dig it out one day because I'm curious to know, like, what the exact date I bought those was.
Okay.
But... You know, it was, but it still was a case where it's like, it took a couple days, but you could still walk in and buy them.
Yeah.
You know, now when they sell Nike stuff, they don't even put it on the shelf anymore. It all goes online and like, raffles what, the Foamposite was one of the first ones, I think, where it was just like, we can't do this because there's going to be riots.
You're someone I think has like a unique perspective on Nike SB. We were actually looking at it the other day, content on the website talking about old Nike SB dunks, and I think story you had done was like the 100 greatest Nike SBs of one all of those. Time.
That's insane. Hold on. Let me interrupt. Welty was upset.
Yeah,
he was very upset.
I thought the list. I looked back at it, but in perspective, it makes sense, but the list was fucking awful looking back at it. You had, like, the original, like, Reese Forbes, like, Hunter Dunks.
And Russ,
like,
Russ wrote the list?
Or it,
probably. It was I was probably at least one of them.
You and Nick Engvall put it together.
Yeah. That would make sense.
And it was at, like, 88 on the list out of the 100 best. Then you had a pair of, like, lime green Janoskis at, like, 47. And I'm, like, looking back at this, I'm like, this makes no fucking sense as far
as...
But I imagine you're the sort of guy I know from knowing you where you have certain, like, you might have a vendetta against a certain shoe and you'll be like, well, fuck that shoe. Like, you didn't put the Dooms on there on purpose because you like MF Doom and you thought that shoe sucked.
I don't know if I thought the shoe sucked, but, like, that whole side of things was always weird to me.
What side?
Just, like, the artist shoe where it's like, and especially someone like Doom where it's like, okay, how much did he really have to do with this? You know, a guy who sends imposters out to his own concerts, like, is he really worried about, like, an actual
dunk? You think he sent an imposter to Beaverton to help design the show?
Entirely possible. But it's funny, and, like, you know, brief name drop, but, like, I did all the text for the Nike SB book they did with Rizzoli, and one of the guys I got to talk to about it was Jay Maskus of Dinosaur Jr., and I didn't like that shoe. Like the silver,
I don't know if that's on,
I don't know if that ended up on the list at all.
I don't think that was just a weird shoe.
2005, something like that, maybe a little later.
Yeah,
no, 2006, 2007 That was
he told me like the reason he did an all silver shoe is like it's based on Ace Frehley's boots when he was in Kiss, and I'm just like, damn, that's a good story.
Makes sense now.
And like after I talked to him about it, like I started scoping like. Round two's Instagram, just in case a pair popped up. Because I'm like, now I kind of want to get a pair of these. So yeah, I mean, a good story will help. I have nothing against Reese Forbes.
Yeah.
And if I haven't looked at that list in a long time, but I would bet the Forbes, the original tan suede one from the first round, that's probably on there and probably pretty high.
Because I remember,
I love that
shoe. There was one, I think it was at like 88. It was like the Slam City Dunks, which I think a lot of people
I love those.
View as kind of a good shoe. And then it was like certain things like the Krampus Nike SB Dunk High, which I don't even remember, was at like 43. And I'm like, Russ, did you just like make like
random?
By the way, sorry, I looked it up real quick. Welty is right. I am wrong. It was 2007 for the
dinosaur. It was a little
later. Yeah.
But I'm going to guess also, like, it depends on what year that list came out. There's probably a little bit of recency bias with some of the things.
Half the images don't work.
I'm sure half the images don't work.
2013.
And also, like, the way I always looked at lists and even the way I look at lists now is, like, the ranking in the end, like, doesn't matter. You can argue about rankings forever.
What?
Like, to me,
it doesn't
matter. To me, it's just good to be able to write about different things.
Isn't that the whole point of the list is to rank it?
I guess so. But, like, if you're, like... You could argue all day, like, what's the difference between, like, what's number 76 and what's number 77? Who cares?
Right.
No. It matters, Russ. No. Here's why it matters, because this is why we looked up to people like you, because you taught us that it's important to be critical about these things, and it's important to consider how these things play against each other in a cultural space or why they're important to people. So I don't ever want to say it doesn't matter or it's just somebody's opinion.
I think
that's like going, like, to a museum and you're mad that somebody's, like, writing about art, and it's like, why would you ever be critical about that? Like... This is the same thing. We're here to be critical. We're here to determine what's good and what's not good.
I agree with that to a degree.
Because of you.
But you're not going to rank Picasso's best paintings.
But you might say that this one is more important or more valuable from an artistic standpoint and more impactful than this other one.
You might. But I think also it's like maybe there's tiers of things too.
Yeah.
Like, okay, this bunch is more important than this and whatever. So
we talked about Slam and you getting kind of, no pun intended, your foot in the door. But where do you think sneaker media from an editorial standpoint changed over? Was there like a moment when you were like, this is going to be as big as it is now? Again, like we said, you were like the forefather of this. And now with Complex and other publications, it's like, dedicated verticals. Did you have the foresight to see that or what?
I don't know about the foresight. You know, I think for us, it was just being able to chase down things we wanted and things we always dreamed of. You know, it's like, I think the first issue of Kicks with Kevin Garnett on the cover, you know, I think that really sort of pushed things, you know.
When was that?
That would have been, was that 98 or 99? Somewhere in that time frame. I think 98.
Mm-hmm.
And like, that was a Nike single sponsor issue.
Okay.
So... They gave us like what was to that point pretty much unprecedented access, you know? And it's like, I feel like things that I saw or things that Bobbito saw or things that some of the people who wrote about sneakers super early, Gary Warnett.
Rest in peace.
You could look at a shoe and like think like, wow, like who designed this or who came up with the ad for this or like, why is this like this? Mm-hmm. But you had to be super obsessed already to think that.
Mm-hmm.
I think something like Kix, which really like, and man, part of me doesn't want to look at it now because all I'll see is like, oh, why didn't we do whatever, whatever. But like, you know, we talked to Wieden and Kennedy guys. We talked to Jim Riswald for that issue. You know, we talked to Eric Avar. We talked to Aaron Cooper. I think for a lot of people then who maybe were only interested in like, oh, I want to see what the new Jordan is.
Yes.
And buy that issue. You know, maybe that opens you up to like, wait a minute, there's so much more than this. You know, so I think sort of every iteration, whether it was a new magazine or certainly like when the internet blew up, brings in like this next layer of people who are maybe just marginally interested, but a certain percentage of them see something like that and realize this is something they can do. So I think with every sort of expansion, it drew in exponentially more people. I don't know, that probably completely doesn't answer the question.
Did that ever frustrate you though? I know like working in sneaker media, we kind of nerd out about stuff and you want to hear all these stories about, you know, designing like the structure triax, almost like random sneaker shit that you just kind of nerd out on, like the story behind it. But then, you know, you're also dealing with the reality that 98% of the people who are like, you know, clicking on the stories or whatever just want to know the new Air Jordan release date and don't really care much more beyond that. Does that ever frustrate you to find a balance between those two things?
I don't think it frustrates me. And I think like, you know, every person or every generation is going to have their sort of, you know, point that draws them in. And if that happens to be whatever the newest, hottest thing is, that's fine. There's room for that too. You know, and like if that kid who just wants to see whatever the new thing is discovers something older and wants to look into that, you know, I definitely want to be the person who provides that. I would rather have them learn from me or learn from someone else who understands it than them not being able to find out anything and just giving up. Sure. You know, one thing is funny, and I don't know, I feel like this is almost something like that hit me more like once I was out of the day-to-day. Mm-hmm. Like once I was away from Complex and kind of like less caught up in like, okay, what's today's thing? Virgil Abloh had a post on Instagram about streetwear, and it kind of made me mad because he talked about like how, you know, when is enough sneakers or enough t-shirts or enough hoodies? Like things need to go beyond that. And I think I used to kind of think like that with certain things, like how many more Jordan 1s can there be? Or like how many more dunks or whatever? Like, why are we still doing this? But being removed from it, I think, is what made me realize like, no. Like, there's too many for you. And that's it with Virgil too. It's like, dude, you're in your 40s. You've been doing this forever. Okay, fine. You're sick of t-shirts or you're sick of hoodies.
Right.
At the same time, there's some 14-year-old kid who's been wearing whatever his mom bought him who just got his first cool hoodie ever. Yeah. His first cool t-shirt ever. His first pair of sneakers with his own money. Are you going to tell that kid, like, you know what? Nah, this stuff is over.
And that's what I always say recently when I talk about the legs that this has on it. The kids nowadays, I always tell the story about like being home for Christmas a year and a half ago or whatever, and kids glued to their phone, and I was like, oh, they must be playing a game or something, and they're literally looking at price comparisons on the secondary market. And to your point, it's the kids now who are fueling this so crazy. And when we were coming up, it seemed like it was kind of like just us, and now it's like it's almost like comics for kids.
Yeah, no, and I think for, you know, for every one of us who gets jaded about things, maybe from a personal level, it's like, you just have to remember, like, for every one of us, there's a kid who never got into this stuff before, who's just finding out about it. And like, they're going to be psyched.
Yeah.
So to like, kind of be jaded to them is like, man, don't ruin it.
But it's funny to hear your perspective now, because I remember, you know, when you used to do Quick Strike, for those who know, you and Clark Kent very early on had your own sneaker talk show, which I do think kind of like paved the way for us to do.
For the record, I wish if those original files still exist, like there needs to be some director's cuts or some like uncut.
I love that show.
We would do like 40-minute interviews with dudes and it would get cut to a 3-minute segment because the whole show had to be 9 minutes long. So someone released the tapes.
Yeah.
But I remember back then working on it in the later era of the show. I think season 3. It was season 1, season 2, and season 3. And then I remember you were going through the releases. Do we like the shoe? Do we don't? And you're like, there's so many fucking shoes coming out that no one can possibly buy all these. Nike needs to stop making as much sneakers. Kids can't buy all the shoes. But now, full circle, you step aside from it. You're happy about it.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think those two things can coexist. I do think there's too much still. You know, if you walk into a store now and look on the wall, it's absurd. Mm-hmm. You know, like, and that's a retailer, not like a reseller. Like, every era coexisting, you know, and like a must cop drop every week. You know, I'm not going to name names, but like, there's at least one blog that does like the 24 must have shoes dropping this weekend. And it's like, what? Like, what's retail for that? Like, here's your $4,800 worth of shoes. I don't remember who it is. It's someone that starts with an H, I
think. Starts with the H, has an S in there somewhere.
But, you know, it's like, I don't know, just this idea of, like, the quote-unquote must-have things, and there being so many of them, like, I don't know. I think it's easy to get completely overwhelmed by that. Like, I feel like at this point, I'm kind of immune to it. I don't even remember, like, the last pair I went out and bought.
Yeah, like, how much have you slowed down over the years? Do you still buy sneakers on a regular basis?
A ton.
What are some of the recent pickups?
I did buy a pair of the Undercover, what was that, the Daybreak?
Daybreaks.
Okay. Yeah, I bought the blue Daybreaks. I really like those.
Same.
Other than that, honestly, not much. Like, you know, it's realizing, like, if I feel the need to go shopping, like, just go shop in my own stash. Like, there's mm-hmm. stuff that I haven't gotten to yet that, again, like, if I don't get to now, like, they're either going to fall apart or I am. So, it's a race.
Are you still a legendary Essence sale shopper?
You know what? At some point...
Can you explain this joke, Welty? Because this is very esoteric.
Oh, I remember, like, in the complex office, like, every morning you'd be, like, browsing Essence, and you'd be like, hey, look what I found.
When the sale happened, I'm pretty sure I got other people to buy stuff off that by sending them.
You should have
been
doing affiliate links.
True. No, I think at some point after, like, 2 years of that sale, I realized, like, everything I had bought from it, no matter how cheap it was, I either had ended up bringing to a consignment shop or not worn yet, and it's like, all right, maybe stop this. So I think this year it just ended not too long ago, and I did not buy anything.
What was your sneaker of last year, if you had to put a top one on it for
me? I have no idea. I honestly have no idea. I'm not really – I didn't like the Sakais very much, and that's not even off some, like, sour grapes. Just because I like the original shoe, and, like, I didn't like the diving board off the back. Like, mm-hmm. that didn't really vibe for me.
Your boy to your right didn't like it either.
I mean,
okay.
Specifically the heel, you always
– yeah.
And that's for me being old anyway, because, like, I still have pairs from when they initially retroed a bunch of that super the early LDB. Nike running stuff.
Yeah.
I have, like, three pairs of pre-Montreals. And,
yeah, I,
like,
remember you being big on that shoe.
Yeah. Like, every different color of that.
How do you feel about the celebrity influence in sneaker culture today? It feels like it's at an all-time high. We were talking about, you know, the Supreme Dunk SBs and SBs coming back in a way that's funneled through kind of celebrities buying them. How do you feel about it being peak celebrity influence right now?
I mean, it's funny, you know, it's like, I think it's something that's always been there, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's like Farrah Fawcett wearing Cortezes, you know, it's like there's always been that aspect of it. I think now just the volume of how much stuff is constantly available through resale, like there's this huge mass of things that can be brought back at any time. And like for someone like Travis mm-hmm. to be able to go back and, you know, whether it's him or a stylist or someone to dig things out that maybe other people don't know about so much. I don't know. If it's getting cool things back into the mainstream and back to the attention, like I don't even care how they get there.
Mm-hmm.
Like that stuff's cool.
What do you think then about like in the NBA now where you see a lot of the players just digging out, you know, whatever, trying to play like in older sneakers instead of flexing a new like PE sneaker or something like that?
I mean, in one sense, I think it's cool. And shout out to PJ Tucker, who remains the king of it. And like, whatever. No one's coming for him right now. Like, no one's doing what he's doing. I mean, the only thing that bugs me about it is you watch a game on a random Tuesday night and guys are wearing crazier stuff than they would have in the All-Star game in the 2000s. And it's like, to me, like, All-Star was always that big sneaker moment where it's like, guys are going to break out the crazy stuff, whether mm-hmm. it's like, you know, Pippen wearing the red Maestros in 94 or Weber wearing the mirrored Dadas or whatever else it was. Like that was always the one you had to tune into. And now it's like, where do you go from here? Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like the All-Star stuff is probably going to be sort of tame compared to the stuff you see like on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. Especially now that there's less rules around what you can wear like on a regular basis.
I mean, guys are wearing stuff where it's like, really? Like you put that on this morning?
You used to have to do team colors and now you can just do whatever.
You know, and I think there's still moments that stand out. Like for me, like LeBron coming out in the Kobe 1 for that game the other night, like...
Yeah.
You know, that
the 81 points
that
pair
was a lot
for that Lakers game.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, one of my first thoughts was like, oh my God, LeBron, please don't like roll an ankle. Like, don't get hurt. It's cool seeing guys being able to take stuff out. And like, I want to see where that signature shoe model goes. Like, that's something that I've been curious about now, where it's like, before it was like such a status symbol where it's like, I have my own shoe and like, I can do whatever. And now I feel like it's almost a constraint where it's like, I have to wear my own shoe. And someone like PJ Tucker can go and dig in the crates and pull out some random Kobe from 5 years ago. And like, to me, that's more interesting than LeBron wearing whatever the latest 17
LeBron
is.
LeBron 23 or 20. Right. Yeah.
Or Kyrie or whoever.
You said it a couple years ago that you're more interested about what a player wears to the game than in the game. Still feel that way?
Yeah. And I think everything's caught up with that now, which is crazy. Mm-hmm. I forget when I said that. But like, you know, now it's like, you see all the shots of these guys in IG and like, obviously PJ wearing one pair and carrying another pair. Like, because that to me, like, and that goes back to the signature guys where it's like, well, I know what LeBron's going to wear on the court. He's going to wear whatever his latest signature is. What's he going to wear to the game? Because that's something like that probably is more, you know, I don't know, more of a signifier of his taste or of his, of what he likes.
What was the last sneaker project that you were really excited about or campaign that you were like, they nailed this? Has there been any recently?
That's a good question. I mean, wow. On the spot. I'm not sure what the last one was. If it hits me, I'll let you know. But like, somehow I don't, maybe I'm wrong.
Maybe the
like,
shoes you did with Adidas.
What, the
quick strike?
The quick strike.
Yeah. The quick strike ones are good. Well, the I did a one with Iverson too that was just a friends and family sort of thing that like.
I didn't get a pair.
That was, I did a bad job with my, like I never followed up much.
And no Reebok deal either. So.
Apparently we're not friends.
Dior Jordan 1s. We need to talk about it. What do you think?
I understand why it happened. I don't particularly care about it. Like, it's not something I'm into. Like, I didn't understand, like, if you're going to do a high fashion Jordan 1 and a high fashion brand partnership, why not LV? You've already got a relationship with Virgil. Like, I don't understand where the Dior thing comes from.
It's Kim Jones.
And then for them just to do, like, basically an authorized Canal Street version of a Jordan 1 with the Dior fabric on the swooshes, like,
that's not impressed.
And, like, to me, you take the Dior logo off, the colorway doesn't even do anything for me. Like, and again, like, whatever, I'm 40 whatever years old, that's not a shoe that's aimed at me. But it's like, I don't know, that's just a shoe that people are going to wear because they can get it.
How about the New Beginnings pack, the Airship and the Air Jordan 1, something that has a legacy story like that, especially one that you are close to?
Yeah, I mean, that stuff to me is really cool. When they really dig into the history and like bring it out like that, and like to do the ship as like a mid-cut, which is what he wore with like a lower sole. I mean, the regular Airship was like a Frankenstein boot. It was like mad high. You know, if a small percentage of the people who either get that pack or see that pack like delve deeper into that Jordan rookie history, like it did its job. That's awesome.
Is there any particular sneaker you're still waiting for a retro for? I mean, you were around when all these shoes came out originally, so I assume there's some stuff that you wish you could actually get your hands on that hasn't been made.
I think early on, there was a period where I was psyched to see certain things come back. And I think I've seen so much come back now and get bastardized and get have things done wrong or come back with not great materials or then get
proportions
like
proportions don't look right
or get churned out in all these like different colorways. Like, I kind of anything that hasn't come back yet, I kind of don't want to see come back. Like, I mean, I've talked about it before and I know I've written about it before, but like, you know, the Air Flight 89 High was a huge shoe for me. Like, I had those in high school. That was like the first like $100 shoe I had, really. And like, there was a period when like I really wanted to see those come back, and I've kind of flipped over, and now like I really hope they never come back. Like, I've got too many good memories in that shoe to see like 8 SKUs of it released in like plastic leather and like, you know, a camo version, and like just leave it alone.
Being such an honest guy about shoes, and you know that like in the industry that we worked in for the longest time, you couldn't really even be critical of sneakers because you have to work with the brands as well. So if you're like, fuck you, this shoe sucks, then you probably sometimes you may get an angry, you know, email from someone. Were you ever worried about like kind of towing that line?
Not particularly. You know, I think like there's a difference between just saying something sucks and telling people why maybe you don't like it. And I
feel
don't
have to say fuck you.
Okay.
He does. But I feel I've always felt like if you're constructive about it and if they know who you are, like you can sort of talk about that stuff. If you're coming at it from like a reasonable space, like I think it's okay. I do seem to recall writing a few things that might not have stayed active online because of concerns. But yeah. I feel like those concerns always took place at a higher level than me. Like I don't think I would ever like temper my own feelings or my own voice because I was worried about like what the reaction would be.
One thing I was thinking about last night, I knew you were coming in, is it's kind of a random question, but I'm wondering if there's one that sticks out to you, the best press trip you've ever been on. Because I know we've been on some together, and there's like definitely, I think the Jordan 23 was awesome. Like,
yeah.
And
yeah. The Miami trip for the Wade, the Fly Wade.
It's actually perfect question, right? Right after not pissing off sneaker brands, you go into sneaker brands.
But does one stick out throughout the years?
I mean, the Jordan 23 was probably like the biggest thing. I mean, playing on the floor at
they announced our names.
United Center. I remember, like, I was guarding Bobito in that game. You know, it's like, I didn't get to go to the one. I'm still kind of jealous of that one that went to Jordan's house. I forget what shoe that was.
I didn't go to that,
They did one where you, like, played on the floor at Jordan's house. That would have been insane. I probably would have, like, collapsed. The 32 was really big, too, in Italy. I mean, they flew us to Italy for it. It's like, okay, this is insane.
The 23 is when we went to the steakhouse and he showed up, right?
Yeah. And somewhere, and they're like not...
He means Michael Jordan.
They're not for... I think they're not for publication. I forget what the whole thing was, but I have like a couple photos of me and Lang Whitaker from Slam talking to Jordan. And it's primarily Lang talking to Jordan, and I'm just kind of standing there looking like an idiot. But yeah, I mean... And didn't we go to like... Because the steakhouse was right near where he worked out maybe or something.
I think so, yeah.
It was like 163 Blue was the name of the place. It was a weird... Yeah. He was like... ownership.
That was your favorite press trip you've been on as well?
I think so. Just to have the Bulls announcer announce your name and like run out on the court was so crazy to me.
It was super
crazy. What was the stat line looking like?
Stat line, 3 turnovers, 2 assists, 4 points in 12 minutes.
No, I was going to say, what was your favorite press trip that you had been on?
Sorry. Brendan.
I was in Monza in Italy for the original Breaking 2 attempt with Nike. It was a special moment. You know, I love that whole line of shoes, all the Zoomfly family. So
you ran a 202, I believe.
There was one point in the weekend, because those press trips, they have you running a lot and very active. And I think I had ran more miles than I had slept hours. Well, yeah, I got it. I know this.
I just wanted us all to say it.
What about you?
No, I think when I got to design my own 101 New Balance shoe in the UK.
I knew it was going to be kicking back bruised with the lads.
It was definitely going to be either New Balance or Adidas.
Or the time that Brendan Dunn could have killed Travis Scott in Houston.
Jesus. Talking about press trips, one that was really special to me and now even more special, we went to Kobe's last game, like 5 of us, me, Mark Anthony Green from GQ and Lance Fresh, Nike flew us out and we took a helicopter to the last game. And just thinking about that, sometimes we're in these moments where, not that we take it for granted, but we don't realize how special these things that we all get to do are. And just thinking back to witnessing that game last week was just crazy.
A lot of that, it's funny, like how some of that stuff worked out with games where it's like, who knows that he's going to score 60 in his last game? Or like, I don't remember if this was the Flyweight trip you were on, but was that the same one where we went to the game with them when they played the Cavs?
I wasn't on that one.
There was a Flyweight trip where they played the Cavs and you're there for Wade, you're there with Jordan, you're in a box. And that was the game when LeBron came and dunked on one end, and then Dwayne Wade comes down the other way and ends Anderson Varejao's like entire life. And it was like one of the most ridiculous dunks I've ever seen in person. And it's like, wait a minute, we're here for this guy. Like, how is that not scripted?
Well, we can't thank you enough for coming in.
We
all worked together, and we could have kind of recorded this quote unquote emergency podcast, but we wanted to wait to have someone like you who could do the Kobe Bryant legacy justice, discuss it with us. And you are definitely kind of like the North Star of sneaker editorial for us. And it's always a pleasure to chop it up with you. And
appreciate
those 7 years we worked together, something that I'll always cherish. Everyone learns so much from you. And again, I think everyone's going to enjoy this, and thank you so much for coming in.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And it's funny, like, people reached out after Kobe died to write things, and like, I just couldn't do it. Yeah. I still haven't written anything yet. Yeah. And like, I kind of want to at some point, cause I feel like I should, but at the same time, it was just all too close. So like,
got it.
Just being able to talk about it is good.
Yeah, Russ, we're so happy to have you in here. I mean, I think after Kobe's death, everyone has been so much focused on telling the people in their life that they are important to them, and Russ is so important to us. Mm-hmm. We love you, Russ, and we're so happy that, like, you know, it's crazy. Like, I had this moment after even the Clark episode of, like, you know, when I told that story about 10 years ago trying to buy a pair of Air Max 1s and thinking, oh, Clark Kent got them all, mm-hmm. and now I'm sitting in a room with
yeah,
Clark
Kent.
Yeah,
it's amazing,
Kent. Man. And I feel the same way about Russ. Like, I'm sitting in a room with Russ Banks, and that's still a crazy thing to me and a thing I'm so thankful for, because you really gave us, people who work in sneaker media, a lineage, you know, a real clear path of, like, Russ Bobbito here, Gary Warnett here, and we're happy to just do our best to try and follow in that tradition.
Yeah, it feels surreal.
I would put Gary ahead of both of us, but...
Rest in peace, Gary.
And again, thank you so much, and we cannot wait for the book, and we can't wait for your next Complex piece. I know my go-to, like, retweet of Russ Bankston's articles whenever they hit Complex is the best writer on the subject of sneakers, and we'll that's how we really feel.
Russ Bankston. Can you say it? Because somebody actually Russ got Bankston. Mad at me.
Bankston. I don't know.
Somebody got mad at
Try
me.
Try to like, spell it, though, and don't
How many times have you been on a press trip and the brand has spelt your name wrong?
You have jerseys with your name.
I could have a literal collection of things that are spelled wrong. But
do you want to put it on the record? How to spell it?
It's T before S. That's
there
all.
There you go.
And also, not the oldest guest that we've had so far, right? That'd be Clark?
Oh, probably.
Right. I don't know. That part's getting cut out.
We
ended so good. But thanks again. And this is the Complex Sneakers Podcast, available everywhere you consume podcasts, Friday, 6 a.m. We'll see you guys next week. Our producer is Shiva Bayet. Sound engineering done by Craig Clayton and Jasmine Plata. Special thanks to Dave Matthews and Jennifer Stewart. The Complex Sneakers Podcast is a production of the Complex Podcast Network.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.